Hello and welcome to the Total Football Analysis podcast. My name's Chris Darwin and I'm joined today by our lead analyst Lee Scott. And we're going to be looking ahead to the new European season, talking a little bit about Chelsea, Liverpool, Bundesliga and Ajax. Lee, how's your summer been?
It's been good, thanks, Chris. Yeah, really good. Lots of football, obviously, with the World Cup. And for once, the weather in Scotland and Aberdeen has actually been quite good. So we've been outside quite a bit. It makes a nice difference.
Fantastic. And we should touch on the World Cup very, very briefly. I mean, I think we both agree that in terms of tactical quality, it wasn't the greatest World Cup ever. But in terms of sheer drama, excitement, narratives and pretty much everything, it was one of the best ever.
I think so. I think that any international competition now, you're not going to find the tactical quality you do at club level. There simply isn't enough time for national coaches to prepare their sides tactically to the level that we see from the top sides in European football, certainly. So it's not unusual for teams to be a little bit, shall we say, poorer tactically. But as you say, in terms of excitement, in terms of narrative, and in terms of capturing the people's imagination, it was definitely one of the best in my living memory.
No, definitely. But of course, I mean, it's only been finished a matter of days, weeks. I mean, I think it's 3 weeks or so, and we're already gearing ourselves up for the European season, which at some levels has already kicked off. The champion. We're recording this on Thursday, the 2nd of August, and the championship gets underway in England tomorrow. And then the English Premier League the week after that. And we're going to be, as I say today, talking a little bit about Chelsea and then Liverpool initially before moving abroad to Germany in the Bundesliga and then Ajax and how they're getting on in their new sort of season, which has started already in Europe. So anyway, on to Chelsea. So Lee, Chelsea. It's been a long time coming for them to be able to announce the appointment of Maurizio Sarri as their new coach, with Antonio Conte actually taking the first 2 days of pre-season whilst daring Chelsea to actually sack him. What can we expect to see from Chelsea under Maurizio Sarri?
Yeah, it was such a strange situation, wasn't it? We had Napoli appointing Carlo Ancelotti a good few weeks ago, but they'd essentially decided that they were going to, in name only, keep Sarri on the staff. So he was given an advisory role on the same salary that he was the head coach, and just basically left to do nothing, save for the knowledge that they knew that Chelsea would come for him at some point and there would be a fee involved with taking out his contract. So it was one of the stranger managerial situations that we've had so far this pre-season. But I think that going into next season, a lot of people are really only familiar with Maurizio Sarri from his time at Napoli. And with Napoli, obviously, they became famous, especially last season, I think, for that 4-3-3 that they played, and that was his de facto tactical system, that was his go-to. But previous to that, he'd spent time at Empoli in Tuscany, and at Empoli, he'd played a couple of different styles. There was a midfield diamond, there was a three-at-the-back system, so he's not dogmatic in that he'll only stick to one system, and that'll be that. But I think that with Empoli, he was slightly limited by the quality of players at his disposal. So I think that had a little bit more to do with his tactical flexibility. Whereas at Napoli, he had the quality of player that meant that he could really play the way that he wanted to. And I think that's why we saw the evolution of this 4-3-3 to the point last season where Napoli were comfortably one of the most exciting and attractive teams to watch in European football. I think that coming into this season, we will see Chelsea in the 4-3-3, but I think it'll be interesting to see exactly how he sets up that midfield.
Well, exactly, and you mentioned there that Napoli had a higher quality of player to be able to work with, and it does look like he's got funds to spend on Chelsea, unless, of course, you go by the fact that Rob Green was their first signing on a free transfer. But the money's certainly there, and as we've been covering on fieldchelsea.com, one of our sister sites, the transfer rumour around Chelsea is massive at the moment, if not so much in getting deals over the line. So there's going to be signings coming in. And would it be right to then assume that Sarri's going to be bringing in players that he feels are going to be of the standard to play this 4-3-3? Because Napoli went very close to the Serie A title last season, and he's certainly got a framework there which is going to provide success if he could even increase the quality of his players at his disposal. Not knocking what Napoli had, there's obviously some fine players in there, but if he could just make that squad a little bit better, then surely he's going to continue with this system.
I think so. I think that the problem we will see at Chelsea with Sarri is something that's indicative of what happens when football clubs don't have a long-term strategic plan. There's a tendency, even at the top level of football, for clubs to live almost year to year in terms of their coach and their preferred style of play and the kind of players that they need to fit that structure. And that's certainly something that we've seen at Chelsea. Chelsea have spent now, what was it, two seasons under Antonio Conte. Obviously, that first season was sensational. When they went on to win the league, they were excellent throughout. But the entire transfer and recruitment strategy for those two seasons was built around finding players that would fit the 3-4-3, 3-5-2, if you like, system that Conte favoured, at least for the first year. So you've now got players who, like Marcos Alonso, who is a left wing back. Has he got the quality to play left back as well under the system that Sarri would want? That's debatable. So you're left with players who are slightly out of their comfort zone in terms of where they like to play and where they're able to play, or even with their skill set, with Sarri preferring. Sarri doesn't like, it's not possession football for Sarri, especially under Napoli last season. It's a very quick, vertical, quick passing game with the ball being moved very quickly through the thirds of the field in the attacking phase. And that is where I think Chelsea will struggle with the players that they have at their disposal. If you look, for example, at the front three, you've got Eden Hazard on the left, perfect. He's a player who I believe could fit almost any role on any side, so he's somebody who will be key for them, and I think he's slightly better than Lorenzo Insigne, who obviously Sarri had at Napoli last season. Different kinds of players, but I think that Hazard has greater quality. And then on the right, if they could keep a hold of Willian, obviously there's a lot of interest in him at the moment, with the likes of Barcelona being linked and Manchester United being linked. If they could keep a hold of him, I think he'll have a key role to play on the right. But who will be the forward for Sarri? Morata is out of favour, apparently. Giroud, as we saw over the World Cup, he's a very functional striker. He's a great squad player and a great piece to have on your bench, but is he a Dries Martin type who'll drift into the half spaces or come back and link in with the midfield? I don't think he is. So I think that we're either going to see Chelsea turn at some point early in the season to Michy Batshuayi, or we're going to see them go out and try and spend on a striker. But there's a shortage of strikers in the market at the moment that are available for any kind of decent fee.
No, that's very true. And in the last 48 hours, we've seen the conclusion of the Gonzalo Higuain rumour, where Chelsea were being heavily linked. He's now going to AC Milan on loan for, I think it's two seasons they've signed a loan deal on there. Yeah. And next on the list is, obviously, when you go down the list of strikers in Europe who might be due a move, not even wanting a move, is Robert Lewandowski at Bayern Munich, who is now the main striker to be linked to Chelsea. But again, realistically, Bayern Munich don't seem keen to sell, and there's not been a lot coming out of Lewandowski's agent's mouth to suggest that Chelsea is a preferred destination for him. I actually thought, going slightly off piece here a little bit, Lee, that we might see this as a moment where Eden Hazard is given any role that he wants in this system to make him stay at Chelsea, and that we could see him move into the central position to play the Dries Mertens role, but also a little bit like Messi made that move from a wider area to a central area under Guardiola at Barcelona. What do you think about that as a potential option?
I think that's certainly a very interesting idea. It's not something I've really thought about, but he has got the skill set to do that. Whether he would be comfortable in a central role, I think, is almost another matter. We've seen him quite often for Chelsea over the last couple of seasons. There will be times where he either naturally drifts from the wide areas, the central areas, into almost the 10 to the hole behind the striker, or he will play there from the start, and he's got that range of movement that he's able to go left or right, he's able to carry the ball or play quick combinations. he would be a very interesting option. And that is something, obviously, that did happen with Sarri, with Dries Mertens. He was originally a wide player. He was a wide player when Napoli signed him. But they moved him into the central areas when they had a lack of strikers. And he exploded over the last couple of seasons in Naples. So it is something that perhaps they could look at. But then as soon as you do that, you leave a gap in the left-hand side. And that's another one that's not easy to fill in the current market.
No, exactly. Well, one player that Chelsea have moved for successfully, and Sarri went straight back to Napoli to make this deal happen, was for Jorginho, the holding midfield player. And I say holding midfield player, obviously he's a lot more than that. What do you think the signing of Jorginho brings to Chelsea, and also really then the knock-on effect for N'Golo Kante in the role?
I think that Jorginho is one of the premier midfielders in European football, not so much a defensive midfielder. He's very much more of a controlling midfielder who plays deeper. That's not to detract in any way from N'Golo Kante, who is one of the best midfielders in world football. I think we saw again at the World Cup just how valuable he is, and almost just how valued he is by his teammates whenever he goes. They all greatly appreciate his contribution and his ability to... I mean, the saying goes that you have two players and one in N'Golo Kante, because he seems to be everywhere every time. I think that the sign of Jorginho, he will play at the base of the midfield, but I think that almost frees Kante up. If you look at Napoli last season, they played with Jorginho as the controlling midfielder deeper, and then you had Alan, the Brazilian midfielder, who played as one of the number eights. He's very much a similar kind of player to N'Golo Kante, not the same quality, but a similar kind of player profile, in that he is able to press extremely well. So you're going to have a situation where Chelsea have a player like Kante playing further up the field. As soon as the opposition manage to win the ball back, Kante is going to be right into them. He's going to be pressing high up the field. He's going to be looking to disrupt their offensive phase, their transition. And we're going to see a lot of opportunities for Chelsea to win the ball back high up the field around the opposition penalty area. And that's going to create more chances and more ability opportunities for Chelsea to get goals. I think that Kante will almost have a free role within that midfield. We will see him drop back, but more often we'll see him free to go up and press the opposition and harry the opposition, cut past the lanes, and really almost evolve his game to the next level.
That's an interesting point with Kante. I mean, it's going to, if anything, add more to his game than take away from it, which I think was some of the Chelsea fans' initial concern with the signing, that why would they change something that has worked so well for them so far. But then if you look at the rest of the midfield, Lee, how do you see that shaping up? Are there more Chelsea midfielders in the squad already that can play the third role, or are Chelsea going to have to dip into the market again? I mean, they've been linked to Matias Vecino of Inter in Italy, the Uruguayan midfielder. Do you think that Sarri's going to have to recruit to get that balance right in there?
I think the balance is going to be very difficult. I don't think Vecino is necessarily the answer. I think he's an additional piece. I think that the third of these midfielders is the one that we haven't talked about yet. At Napoli, it was Marek Hamšík, who played in the left-hand side of the central midfield, and he was very much more of an attacking threat. He was a player who moved forward and combined with the forwards and arrived in the penalty area. I don't think Chelsea at the moment have a player who quite meets that profile. They've got Cesc Fabregas, obviously, back in his earlier days when he was just breaking through as a player at Arsenal. I think that he would have fit that role perfectly. He was very, very good at getting all over the field and getting forward and having assists. But now he's much more of a deeper player. I think he's almost a player who gets caught in no man's land in terms of his best position, his best role with his profile. I think he's a player who will look more to slow the game down, which it won't suit Napoli, it won't suit Chelsea, sorry, slip of the tongue. That's where the problem lies. It would be interesting if Chelsea were able to have Ruben Loftus-Cheek back into the squad and playing in that role. I think that he could be one that could evolve into a player who's very good in that side. But if not, then I think that is something that Chelsea may look to address over the remaining weeks of the transfer window. But don't forget, the transfer window is very, very soon coming to a close, so these teams don't have a lot of time to get more in.
Yes, as I said at the start of the podcast, we're recording this on Thursday, the 2nd of August, and the window shuts in just 1 week's time, which is not controversial, but I know that a couple of the Premier League managers have come out and said that it puts them at a disadvantage, especially considering it's only in England where the window is shutting. In that time scale. Chelsea, as we've said a couple of times, are still being linked to more and more signings. Today's one on Thursday is Jack Grealish being the latest name to be linked potentially to play that Hamsik role. But Lee, do you think Grealish is anywhere near ready to take on such a responsible role in what Chelsea would hope to be a top four, top three side next season?
No, I don't. I think that there's no doubting his potential. I think he showed that towards the tail end of last season with Aston Villa, and certainly the playoff final, if anyone watched that, Grealish was a standout player on the field, even though his team lost. He has that rare ability to carry the ball in central areas, to run with the ball, to isolate defenders one-on-one and go past them. I think that's something that is very intriguing to teams. Being able to do that in central areas opens up the whole field. I think that if he was brought into a Chelsea or even to a Spurs, which is the other club that's been heavily linked to him, I think he's coming in more to sit on the bench for at least the first 6 months of the season to almost learn and acclimatise to the level of football that he would be then playing. After that, going into next season, the season after that, there's certainly nothing stopping him if he continues to develop. But for any club looking to take him in, I don't think you're looking at an instant fix for a top six side.
And again, he would just be yet another young player at Chelsea whose yes. career, where we've seen before, he's at an age where he needs to be playing every week, and there's no guarantee that he's going to be getting that sort of development time at Chelsea. Interestingly, though, I did run some stats on Grealish this morning for a piece on fieldchelsea.com. And he actually, the caveat is, of course, that Grealish was playing for Aston Villa in the Championship, but then Ruben Loftus-Cheek was playing for Crystal Palace, a struggling team in the English Premier League. Now, Grealish actually outranked Ruben Loftus-Cheek on many of the key sort of things that you would expect from a midfielder. So statistically, there wasn't a great deal between them, if you can find enough of a parallel between the levels to make that conclusion draw true. Equally, Grealish's heat map, although he was playing for Villa mainly as a 10 behind a front man, he did spend a lot of his time drifting into those what sort of left-sided areas that Hamsik sort of did for Napoli. So to put the two heat maps together was actually incredibly similar.
Okay, that's interesting.
That said, I don't think Grealish is. I agree. I don't think Grealish is anywhere near ready to be taking on such a senior role.
There's no doubt he's a very, very good young player. He's a player who, as I say, if he continues to develop, you're looking at a top four player. But it's that next step in his development. He has to be very careful when he makes this next move, because we've seen too many examples of young players who've made the step before their big step, if you like, and they've taken the wrong one. If you look at Leicester, they've signed... Who's the lad they signed from Norwich? I should know this because he used to play for Aberdeen.
Was it Madison?
Madison. I had Middleton in my head. James Madison, that's right. I think that he's taken a very intelligent step in going from Norwich City to Leicester City. I think that's somewhere where he'll be given a chance to develop further. He'll get a lot of minutes in the Premier League, and he'll have a lot of exposure to top-flight football. And I think that within one or two seasons, we'll see him make a big move. I think that's the kind of step that Grealish should really be looking at.
No, I'd have to agree with that. So Sarri, earlier in his career, he's been good for some younger players, I seem to recall. So do you think the youth academy at Chelsea and the vast squad that they've got out, or certainly had out on loan last season, is suddenly seeing more of a future at the club?
I hope so. Back especially when he was at Empoli, again, the resources at his disposal were very different when he was there. But he had a number of young players in on loan at Empoli whose careers he really launched. The likes of Piotr Zielinski, the Polish midfielder who's at Napoli, took him to Napoli with him. And Leandro Paredes, the Argentinian midfielder who's now at Zenit St. Petersburg but looking for a move back to top level European football. I think that the two of those especially were young players who were given a lot of time, a lot of minutes, and the ability to really come into their own under Sarri. I would think that he will look to do the same thing at Chelsea. I think that the interesting thing about Sarri, if you've heard one of his first interviews as a Chelsea coach, he made the comment that he finds transfers boring. He's not interested in speaking about transfers. He'd rather just coach the players that he has. He's very much like Pep Guardiola in that he's excellent at getting the best out of his players and to help them get better, help them improve players in the training field. So young players, I've seen him come out today and he said that Callum Hudson-Odoi, the young attacking midfielder or winger that Chelsea have, the England Youth International, he's came out and said that he will stay with the club this season and not go out on loan. So he's one, I think, that we could look to for Sarri to develop and perhaps pick up some first team minutes as the season goes on.
I mean, Sarri's not going to be short of potential at Chelsea. You've got Mason Mount, you've got obviously Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who really has to... This is a breakthrough season now for Loftus-Cheek. He didn't disgrace himself at all in the World Cup. He had a very, very good season at Palace last year, and he's got to be thinking now that he deserves a chance at Chelsea, or they've got to let him go so he can actually further his career. And even someone like Andreas Christensen at the back, he must be looking at Sarri going, OK, I know I played half the games under Conte last season, am I going to get this chance now to really push on and become a regular Champions League central defender?
Yes, I think that a lot of these young players now are looking for that next step, and it's always the problem when you talk about player development and pathways. For a young player at a top club, they have to be able to see a way for them to get into the first team, whether that's through trusting their own ability or it comes through an injury to a senior player or a coach trusting in them. And I think this is the case now with Sarri and with these young players. If he turns to the younger players, Christensen, I think, will play. I think that he will be one of the starting centre-halves for Chelsea this season. And I don't doubt that. I think he'll play a very important role in the defence. But I think Loftus-Cheek, Mason Mount's gone back out on loan, unfortunately, to Derby County. I think, again, he'll do well there. Anyone who followed his time with Vitesse Arnhem in Holland, he was talked about in terms of player of the season at the Eredivisie when he was there, so he had a great impact. But I think Loftus-Cheek and perhaps Chalobah when he comes back into the squad, I think the two of them really need to be looking at getting some first team minutes and making an impact in the first team squad, or they're going to have to look to move on.
Well, that rounds up our bit of Chelsea then from their pre-season. And don't forget, if you're interested in more Chelsea analysis, you can go over to our sister site, fieldchelsea.com, to catch up on all our thoughts of what's happening at Stamford Bridge there. Next, we're going to move on to Liverpool. Lee, have Liverpool had the best transfer window then out of all the major clubs?
I think you could certainly make that argument. I think that Liverpool have come out this pre-season, and they have systematically addressed every one of their greatest needs going into the new season. The only thing that they're perhaps missing is that forward, the striker who can come in and either create chances from central areas or take some of the minutes away from Roberto Firmino to give him a rest. I know that they've said that Daniel Sturridge will get a chance again this season, and he is a player who at the top of his form certainly can be that replacement level player who can come in and do a very good job for Liverpool, but whether he stays fit or not is a question. So you look at the signing, for example, of Alisson. They took a look at their goalkeeper situation and realised that they desperately needed to make a move to improve that area. And they identified their top target and they went and got their top target. I think that's the most impressive thing. There wasn't this case of they went for Alisson, were put off by the cost, so ended up with Jack Butland, for example. A perfectly serviceable keeper, but not at Alisson's level. They've done the same thing last season with Naby Keita. They identified Naby Keita as the player that they wanted. And they were willing to play hardball with Red Bull RB Leipzig to make sure they got that deal over the line, and again they did. So I think that the way that they work within the transfer market and identifying their top target and just going after that one player instead of settling for second or third best, I think that's what makes them stand out in terms of transfer business.
From the players that they brought in so far, who do you think is going to prove to be their best signing?
I think that Fabinho I wrote an article on him this week for Total Football Analysis, and in that I referenced the fact that I think he will be the most important signing for Klopp. There's no doubting the quality of Naby Keita. There's no doubting the quality of Alisson. They're top class, world class players. But Fabinho brings that added little bit to the team that I think they really needed, and they really would have benefited from at the tail end of last season. He's a player who's been a captain wherever he's gone. I think that almost, it's almost the added extra that goes unnoticed with players. You look at them play and you can see their tactical, technical abilities. You can see how they fit in different roles and positions, but almost what goes on behind the scenes is almost as important for a player who's been a captain everywhere, who can lead a dressing room, who can pull a team together on the pitch and issue instructions. I think that's something that can be very, very important at the top level, and Fabinho brings that. He also brings the versatility that I think Liverpool really benefit from. He originally, when he came to European football, the Rio Ave in Portugal, and then with the Real Madrid Castilla team, he was a right back, a rampaging attacking right back, and then he moved to Monaco and became a midfielder. He can play defensive midfield, he can do it well, he can play centre half, he can play right back, but he can also play as an eight, very much in the same way that we talked about earlier on with N'Golo Kante. His ability to move forward and press the ball, I think, from that position will be really, really interesting to somebody like Klopp. I think that we may see him begin life as a Liverpool player as the sixth, the defensive midfielder, but I think as the season goes on, he'll be used more and more as the number eight.
I mean, from what you're saying about Fabinho there, he does sound like a, I'm going to go as far as saying, massive upgrade in Jordan Henderson, who we saw perform mainly as a six in England's World Cup campaign. And then when Southgate was looking to close the game out, Henderson a couple of times moved up into eight with Dia coming on and playing behind him. And Henderson really, for me personally, struggled playing in the eight role in that tournament. So for Klopp now to have an upgrade, would you say, in that position, that's got to be a good thing for Liverpool.
I think so. I think Jordan Henderson's very much Marmite for Liverpool fans. Some absolutely love him and value him as a player. Others deride him and think he's their weak link. I think I fall more into the second camp, to be honest. Don't forget, when Henderson was signed by Liverpool, he was signed as an eight. At Sunderland, he was very much an eight. He was a player who was best known for his ability to get up and down the field. He was a box-to-box midfielder. And he's kind of been shoehorned in this role as a six, as a controlling midfielder. His range of pass in the World Cup was slightly better, I think, than we've seen in previous years from Henderson. He did use the field a little bit better, but he's very much limited in that he has a strong preference for the right-hand side. For a controlling midfielder, you want a player who's able to open the field up and use both sides. For a player like Henderson, he's very much limited to one half of the field with his passing. I think Fabinho coming into the role, if he does play there, I think if Fabinho plays as the eight, I would like to see Wijnaldum given a chance as the six. I've said it for a couple of years now, but I think that Wijnaldum would be very, very good as a midfielder in that position. Very much a player like Jorginho. I think he would be able to pass the ball from there. He would be able to pass the ball forwards through the lines or to retain possession and change the angles of attack. So I think that Fabinho, with his versatility, gives Klopp a lot more options, and one of those will certainly be, I think, to look to replace Henderson within the first-choice starting 11.
So why do you think Klopp is so different to the other top coaches when it comes to his recruitment? How are Liverpool set up to best support him now?
I think we touched upon it earlier on. It's this single-mindedness that Klopp has. He's very much in the, as we talked about, Sarri, Guardiola kind of mould, in that he does most of his best work on the training field. But he recognises the importance of recruitment and good recruitment. But again, he's not one to panic in the transfer market. He's not one to be pushed into making a choice that he knows isn't the right one for the club. We saw that last season, again, with Virgil van Dijk. He identified van Dijk at the start of the year as the player that he wanted to come in and control that defensive line for Liverpool. He was the player who would be the first-choice centre-half for the next decade at Liverpool. But Southampton played hardball and didn't want to sell. Liverpool then didn't go out and sign any old centre-half. They didn't go out and sign somebody who Klopp saw as second-best or third-best. They waited. They waited until it got to a point where Southampton's hand was forced and they got the deal done. Van Dijk came in and became one of the most important players in the Liverpool squad almost straight away. He's a player who will be a huge addition and somebody who will go on to become a huge player and go down in history, I think, as a Liverpool player. I think Klopp has this, it's part of his personality, part of his ability to look on the upside instead of the downside of every situation. I think he recognises and identifies that there are times where you need to recruit players, but he also has in mind the player that he wants and he won't be budged from that. And I think what we've seen the Liverpool ownership support Klopp in that. They haven't pushed for signings when it perhaps wasn't the right one. They've listened to the manager and crucially they've given him the funds, especially this season, to back that.
It's been an interesting summer for Liverpool and Liverpool fans. And as much as they would love to keep reminding us that it is the Philippe Coutinho money, surely that pot has now run out. Can you see Liverpool spending again this summer?
I think for the right player they will. Obviously, a reference that I think they still need a forward. I think that Nabil Fekir of Lyon was very much that player that Klopp was interested in, and the deal was very close. I believe that it got to the point where Fekir had his photo shoot done in his Liverpool kit ready for the official unveiling before the deal fell through. So it was just about over the line before it stopped. And I think Fekir almost gives you that balance of a player. He's somebody who could play as the forward. He's comfortable as a nine, almost. It's more of a false nine with him. It's similar to Firmino, and he drops it in deeper areas, but he can also play from the centre midfield or from the left. So I think similar to Fabinho, Fekir would give that versatility in tactical structures and systems that can be very, very important at this level. The other player I think that I've seen Liverpool linked to that I believe that Klopp would take if he got the option, he's somebody who's been linked to a few different clubs now, so there is definitely movement somewhere, is Mateo Kovacic, the Real Madrid and Croatia midfielder. I think Kovacic is now at the point in his Real Madrid career where he really needs to make that decision whether he's happy to be a backup at Real Madrid or if he's going to go on and become a first choice somewhere. But he's a player with the skill set from the centre midfield that I think any top club will want. He's somebody who can carry the ball in central areas. He's good defensively, he's a good passer, he's a good striker of the ball, he scores goals. I think he will bring something. I think that's somebody who Klopp could potentially be looking at. But whether they've got the financial muscle to make another £80 million move, I'm not convinced. You're more looking at the 50 to 60 mark. And although a couple of years ago we'd been talking about these fees thinking they were astronomical, and now it's almost become the norm that £50 million is a reasonably average fee to play for a player. But I think that could be where we see one more move from Klopp and Liverpool. But if not, I think he'd be happy with the squad to go forward.
I'm just going to throw one more wild card into the mix there, because there's been reports coming out of Dortmund that Christian Pulisic's agents have cancelled the contract renewal talks that have been ongoing for some time now, suggesting, as these rumours often do, that Pulisic is interested in now moving on from Dortmund. And there's been a consistent link between Klopp, Liverpool and Pulisic for quite a while now. Is that something that you can see happening? They can't turn that around in a week, surely.
I'd be very surprised if Pulisic is available and he's somebody who's been linked obviously to Liverpool for a good couple of seasons now. I think that link comes almost as much from the American ownership than it does through Klopp. He's a player who has huge potential. I don't think he's settled on his permanent role yet. He plays wide for Borussia Dortmund. I see him more developing into a 10 or an 8, a player in central areas who can be that driving force going forwards in the attacking phase. I think that's where he'll eventually end up. I don't think, what you've got to remember with Dortmund, they're a team who have history of keeping players to the end of their contract. They did so with Lewandowski before he went to Bayern Munich. He was in the last year of his deal, Bayern Munich made a bid and Dortmund turned it down flat and let him run out his contract, in full knowledge that he was going to go to Munich anyway, but they were happy to do so because it suited them for that season. I think that if the deal does happen, I think it'll be more towards January now. I don't think it'll be this transfer window. The other point is I don't know where he comes in and fits straight away. I don't think he comes in and takes significant minutes from Salah or Mane in the wide areas. So does he play centrally to spell Firmino potentially? But whether he can do that in the Premier League consistently would be another question. So I think there's a lot of moving parts to that deal if it does come through. And I've also seen him linked to Chelsea, I think, over the last couple of days. So there will be other teams interested. But certainly Liverpool are somebody who've been quite notably interested in Pulisic. So it'll be interesting to see if it happens.
Well, as we said earlier in the podcast, being linked to Chelsea doesn't make you mutually exclusive in this transfer window, as Mateo Kovacic has also been linked to yeah. Chelsea. And I'm sure anybody else that we go on to mention over the course of today's podcast has also been linked to Chelsea in the last couple of weeks. Okay, so that wraps up our section on Liverpool today. And of course, if you want to keep more of a close eye, you might be a Liverpool fan yourself, if you want to keep a closer eye on what's happening at Liverpool and our analysis of all things there, head over to liverpoolfchq.com. We're going to head over to the Bundesliga in Germany now. Lee, we just touched on it a little bit with Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp being the obvious link to this. Why do the majority of German clubs move so early in the transfer window?
I think it's a sign of clubs that are exceptionally well run. We talked about it earlier on with Chelsea and their short-termism in terms of their squad planning and development, and they signed players over the last couple of seasons almost exclusively to fit one system, only to change coach to a coach who doesn't play that system anymore. That leaves you at an immediate disadvantage in terms of your transfer planning. I think that the structure of German clubs, most of them have a sporting director and a director of football, and I think they're the ones who plan and execute transfer strategy. I think that's the key point. So clubs in Germany are already at this point towards the end of this transfer window. They're not only planning for January. In German football, January is almost an emergency-only kind of window. It's not one where you'll see a lot of clubs make moves. So they're already really embroiled in their plans for next season, for next summer transfer window. They get their deals done very quickly because they're exceptionally well prepared and ready for it. They know the weak points in their squad and they know what they want to do. The coach is almost not incidental. The coach does have a say to a point depending on how long the coach has been at the club. But the coach will have X amount of players presented to himself for the first day of pre-season, and these are the players at his disposal. So I think the way that they work is very intelligent in terms of a long-term cohesive planning and strategy side of things, as opposed to some clubs, especially in English football, who look to almost panic buy towards the end of the transfer window. And it all feeds into the Sky Sports thing over here with deadline day and, you know, Sky Sports news being outside every stadium, fans taking days off work so they can go and stand outside the stadium. That's short-termism. That's not any way to run a football club for me. So the way they do it in Germany is much more effective.
The whole Sky Sports transfer deadline day culture, I know for a fact, is looked upon and laughed at in other sort of other leading European nations. I'm talking about Spain, Germany, Italy. Not for one second suggesting England as an international side is at that level, even despite doing well in the World Cup. But it's certainly something that is laughed upon for those reasons, because it is panic buying. It is a lack of strategy, and all that sort of all that side of it. The model that Germany operates, surely that makes good common sense for other clubs, even Barcelona and Real Madrid. I mean, we give England a hard time for running clubs with a very scattergun transfer sort of approach. Madrid and Barcelona as guilty as anyone of that. Is this a model that is not just whether other clubs should roll it out, because the answer is obviously yes, but is it a model that's easy for other clubs to roll out and be successful with?
I think that the continental structure, the one used mostly in Germany with the sporting director, director of football, is one that could be used primarily, I think, if we're talking about in English football here. But I think there would be a lot of blowback initially from fans and media when you see these clubs try to start to change the structure and the way that they work. I think within England and within English football, there's very much the is the last country in European football that really clings on to the importance of the manager in terms of choosing transfer structure and strategy. There are obvious exceptions with Manchester City. They operate a continental model with Bergerestein, the director of football or sporting director, running transfer strategy, and Pep Guardiola is very comfortable with that, so it works well. But there are other examples in the pyramid of English football where similar things happen. Even the likes of Fleetwood Town, they've become famous this summer for the appointment of Joey Barton as their head coach or manager. But Greta Steinsen, the ex-Bolton fullback, is the sporting director there. He's somebody who very much runs strategy at the club and does so very well. So there are clubs up and down the pyramid who have these people in place. They're not really called directors of football, that's the difference. Although the role that they have and the things that they deal with at the club are very much similar to what you see from a director of football. And these tend to be the clubs that are very well run. That's the difference. They're not short-term clubs. They're ones who have good long-term planning in place and good structure. So I think it's something that could be done, but we would really need to move away from this idea that the manager is the one who needs to control all aspects of the game.
Definitely, definitely. And over in the Bundesliga, which club would you say has done the best business so far?
I think that a couple stand out. One of the most interesting ones, and it was covered on Total Football Analysis by Tobias Hahn, who's one of our writers and an excellent one at that. I'd asked him to have a look at Stuttgart, who they really hit the headlines at the start of the transfer window when they announced 5 signings, I think, within an hour. They just announced them one after the other, and there's been more business done since, but they've added very, very well. There were 3 key ways that really they looked at taking players at the club. They signed experienced players in Gonzalo Castro, the ex-Dortmund midfielder. He was a midfielder who wasn't the quality Dortmund needed. He wasn't a Dortmund player, but at Stuttgart he will be a very, very important part of their midfield. But perhaps the most interesting one was one from abroad. They brought in the Manchester City right-back, Pablo Maffeo, a Spanish right-back. He's a player who last season was on loan at Girona, the club that Manchester City have an interest in. He spent the full season there and he drew rave reviews for his performances. At one point against Barcelona, he all but marked Lionel Messi out of the game with his the kind of style of play that he has. So he was somebody who was coming back to Manchester City, and similar to the Chelsea youngsters that we talked about earlier on, he was at that point in his career where he had to decide whether he was going to be happy picking up backup minutes or if he was going to move off somewhere else and kind of give himself a chance somewhere else. So he took the very bold move, I think, to move to the Bundesliga, and Stuttgart picked him up for a very good deal. He's a player who I think will go on to be a Spanish international, so he's a very good pickup. Then Stuttgart also signed the younger players, the domestic players that have the potential to go on and become really good first-team regulars at Bundesliga level. The one that really stood out for me was a centre-half from Freiburg called Marc-Oliver Kempf. He was a product of the Freiburg Academy. They're very well known for their ability to develop young players, and they give them chances in the first team at a young age, and the better ones go on and thrive, and Kempf was one of those. He's a centre-half very much in the German mould, and he's very physically powerful, he's quick, but he's also great at using the ball with his feet. So I think Stuttgart have done some of the best business I've seen in European football, not just in German football, and they've I think put themselves in a strong position to go on and challenge for the European places in the Bundesliga next season.
And all that sounds incredibly positive, obviously. But does that actually mean that there's going to be anyone in Germany who challenges Bayern for the title this season?
I think there will be. I think this season Bayern are going to find themselves in a difficult position. Niko Kovac, the new Bayern coach, he was very good for Frankfurt last season. And he's obviously somebody who's very well known to Bayern Munich. He was an excellent player for them and for the Croatian national team. But as a coach, he still has a lot of work to do to kind of prove himself at that level. I don't think he's of the quality of the likes of Jupp Heynckes, obviously, who was back at Bayern Munich again and went, took them straight back to winning and doing well. The other coaches that were linked to that position, the likes of Julian Nagelsmann and Thomas Tuchel particularly, I think they were coaches that could have came in and put their stamp on Bayern Munich a lot more quickly. You get the impression that Niko Kovac is somebody who's come in and he will almost toe the company line, as it were, and the real power still lies with the directors of Bayern, and whether they'll be happy if Kovac and Bayern don't get off to a fast start will be another matter altogether. He could find himself under pressure very quickly. I think that Schalke under Domenico Tedesco, I think they've strengthened well this summer. They obviously were very, very good last year. They'll be looking to push on to the next level. I think RB Leipzig will come again. This time, obviously, their coach has left. Ralf Hasenhüttl's left. They have already announced that Julian Nagelsmann will be their coach from next season. So they're allowing him to see out his contract at Hoffenheim before he moves over to Leipzig. So the interesting move from the coaching standpoint in the Bundesliga has been that Ralf Rangnick, the very famous coach and sporting director for Red Bull, he was the sporting director for the entire Red Bull network before he started only really concentrating on Leipzig. He will be coaching Leipzig next season, so it will be interesting to see if he's kept up to date with the trends and whether he can put together a strong team. But if he can, I think that they will be one that challenges towards the top. But then, of course, you have Borussia Dortmund. I think that Dortmund under Favre this season will be very different to the Dortmund that we saw last season. I think that Lucien Favre was excellent at Borussia Mönchengladbach, and he was excellent for a season at least at Nice. I think that he has players at his disposal at Dortmund that he will use very well. They will go on and they will challenge back up towards the top of the table. So I think that we could see one of the most interesting title races in recent memory in the Bundesliga this year.
Good stuff. That sounds great, because the Bundesliga is a fantastic league to watch, and anyone who's listening to this and hasn't really spent a great deal of time of watching it, it's probably tactically one of the most interesting leagues that you can possibly watch. And the fact that they're always bringing in through young coaches with new ideas makes it even more so, in my personal opinion. Okay, so we're gonna leave the Bundesliga now, and we're gonna head over to Eredivisie in the Netherlands and spend a little bit of time talking about Ajax. So then, Lee, Ajax. I mean, this is a club that most people who've followed you for a while know that hold a special place in your heart, and it's going to be a big season for them as well. How have they recruited over the summer?
They've actually done very well. They've made moves that aren't very Ajax-like, if you like. They've lost, obviously, the main talent they've lost over the summer transfer window has been Justin Kluivert, Patrick Kluivert's son. He was a wide attacker last season who was excellent for Ajax throughout. He a source of a lot of goals, assists, and exciting attacking play, and he moved to Roma. Monchi again pulling his magic at Roma there, but I think that they've gone out and they have used that money intelligently. They've done something they don't do very often, in that they've gone out and signed players that are almost in the prime of their career, as opposed to young players with development potential. So they've gone out and they've taken Daley Blind, for example, back from Manchester United. He was somebody who was sold by Ajax to Manchester United a good few seasons ago. But he comes in with a wealth of experience. He will be that older head in the dressing room, somebody that knows the club and knows the philosophy of the club very, very well. So he's somebody that will come in, and I believe he'll play centre-half beside Matthias de Ligt, obviously another player who's been linked to many big money moves around European football. And with de Ligt being only 18, I think that having Blind playing beside him will give him that sense of stability and almost allow de Ligt to develop at a faster rate than he would if de Ligt was worried about being the primary defender. The other signing they've made is one from Southampton, with the signing of Serbian winger Dusan Tadic. I think that Tadic is again somebody who has extensive experience in the Eredivisie. He played there for a number of seasons before moving to Southampton, and he comes in again adding that little bit of experience, that little bit of extra know-how, if you like. I don't know if he'll be a first choice immediately. I think Ajax have a number of attacking players who are very, very interesting, but he is definitely somebody who will come in and play a lot of minutes in and around the final third of the field. I think he can play in the left, right or in central areas, so he will definitely spend a lot of time kind of playing here and there and almost replacing these players to give them a rest.
I like the Daley Blind move personally, because it reminds me of Louis van Gaal back in the sort of the early to mid 90s when he took Frank Rijkaard back to the club. a move that was then there again to mentor and educate the wealth of young talent that they had at the club, and that turned out pretty well for them. Now, I don't think we're either of us are expecting Ajax then to go on and win the Champions League this season, but it's good to see that they are returning to some of their traditional roots in that respect. And Tadic as well, yeah, very interesting signing. It's I was quite surprised to see him make that move rather than moving slightly up the Premier League ladder. So a big coup for Ajax there. Now, with this in mind, it's got to be safe to presume that they're still intent on bringing their academy players through, surely?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no doubt. I think that Ajax have, obviously, part of the reason that I love the club is that they're very set in their ways and their philosophy of developing young players and providing pathways to the first team. So there are always young talents within young Ajax, the B team, and within the under-19s, you can step up at the first team at any moment. I think that they will be extensively used again this season. I mean, you look at, we've already mentioned, Matthijs de Ligt, only 18, but he's now been a centre-back at Ajax for a good couple of seasons now. You look at Frankie de Jong, the midfielder, who's been heavily linked this summer to Barcelona. You look at Donny van de Beek, the other midfielder that they've got. There are already young players who've come through the Ajax system that are embedded in the first team, and there'll be more added to that this season.
So which ones do you think are going to be the main breakthroughs? Maybe not just this season, but over the next sort of 24 months for Ajax?
If you look this season, I think that there are three that I think will see significant playing time in the first team. I think that in midfield, there's a player called Carol Eiting. He's a young central midfielder and very much in the Ajax mould. He reminds me a lot of the way that the likes of Clarence Seedorf used to play in terms of his ability to knit passes together in the midfield. He's an excellent player at retaining possession and looking for the penetrative pass. So he's somebody who can play at the base of midfield or play as the eight. I think he will eventually come into the first team and get more minutes from the Danish international, Lasse Schöne, and he'll be somebody that fills in for injuries to the likes of Donny van de Beek and Frankie de Jong as well. I think at right back, we have a player called Mazarul. Ajax have... He isn't somebody who came through the Ajax system. He was signed in the youth team at some point, and he's been given his first team debut last season and played again. He's played the first two games of Champions League qualifying this season at right back. He's somebody who's physical, he's powerful, he's quick, but he's very, very good defensively as well as being able to attack. So he gives a good sense of balance to the team. And the final one's a forward who's really interesting. They already have, obviously, Kasper Dolberg, who struggled with injuries last season, and they have Klaas Jan Huntelaar, who's that 1 year older. But a young player I think that we'll see come into the first team more this season is Kaj Sirhus. He's an attacker who has a phenomenal goal-scoring record at youth level at Ajax. He scored some spectacular goals in the youth league, the European Youth League, last season, the season before. I think that he's somebody that Ajax fans are very excited to see play more first-team minutes, and I think that he will certainly score goals in the Eredivisie.
So, as ever with Ajax, it's all sounding very promising. So what does the season actually hold under Erik ten Hag, do you think?
I think the main thing is that fans want to see progression from last year. There was a great deal of disappointment last season when they failed to qualify for European competition. Obviously, the season before, they got all the way to the Europa League final and lost to Manchester United. So failing to make any kind of impact last season really put a dampener on things. But don't forget, the atmosphere at the club at the beginning of last season was very different. They'd just gone through a pre-loss of Abdelak Nouri, the supremely talented playmaker and central midfielder for Ajax, who collapsed on the field in a pre-season friendly and was left with significant brain damage and still hasn't recovered. So that really set the tone to the start of the Ajax season last year. This year, they've already seen off the Austrian side's Sturm Graz 5-1 in aggregate in one of the first qualifying rounds of the Champions League. Now they've got, I think they will do that quite comfortably. So I think we will see Ajax at least qualify for the Europa League, but hopefully the Champions League group stages. Secondly, I think that we'll see them get challenged more significantly for the Eredivisie title. I don't think, the season before last it was Feyenoord, last season it was PSV. I think Ajax are in a much better position this season to challenge and to take the title back.
Excellent stuff. And it's also a good time for us at Ronnie Dog Media in terms of IAX, as we're going to be launching a new website in August, IAXanalysis.com, which no doubt Lee will be figuring heavily on, as well as a couple of our other sort of IAX fan analysts that we've got within our supremely talented squad. So that brings us to the end of today's TFA podcast. It's been great discussing all these points. Lee, if people want to follow you on social media, where can they find you?
The best place would be Twitter. It's at FM Analysis.
Excellent stuff. And if you want to follow the TotalFootballAnalysis.com Twitter account as well, what's that, Lee?
It's at Total Analysis.
Great stuff. Now, we're presuming that most of you are listening to this podcast today because you already know of the website. But if you haven't checked out the website, head over to TotalFootballAnalysis.com to check out all the analysis that we've done. We covered every single match in the World Cup, as well as additional talking points. And we've done some excellent player previews and interesting team previews leading into the new European season as well. So there's plenty of activity on that website. And if you're into all things tactical analysis, which you must be for listening to today's podcast, then there's no better place for you to be getting your written work from as well. Now, if you've enjoyed today's pod, which I hope you have, it would be fantastic if you could leave us a like. Don't forget to subscribe so you can find out when the next one is, because we love to surprise you by putting them out randomly. And please then, if you could leave a comment as well and tell all your friends about how good this podcast is. It means that we can grow and more people will be able to be understanding the context about the game that they love. Lee, after that little monologue at the end, is there anything that you want to add?
No, I think it's great to be back. I think we're going to try and make these podcasts more regular throughout the season, and hopefully add a couple of guests here and there as well, so we're not just listening to our voices. Hopefully people enjoyed it, and hopefully they'll continue to subscribe.
Great stuff. Okay, Lee, well, look, we're planning to be back actually in a few days, looking at the calendar. So we'll have a completely different set of talking points to go over, and I believe we'll be looking to get that out in the middle of next week. So, Lee, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for listening, folks. We've been the Total Football Analysis Podcast.